priority built by goal setting to the now, and that priority, that one thing you can do such that by doing it, everything else will be easier or unnecessary, will show you the way to extraordinary results. And once you know what to do, the only thing left is to go from knowing to doing.
Chapter 15, Live for Productivity. Margarita Tartakovsky said, "Productivity isn't about being a workhorse, keeping busy, or burning the midnight oil. It's more about priorities, planning, and fiercely protecting your time."
Ebenezer Scrooge's story might have been a footnote in literary history, except for this. He acted. Passionate about his new purpose and empowered by a priority that fulfilled it, he got up and got going. Productive action transforms lives. Let's go be productive. We'll never be heard in the movies as the cavalry takes the hill. It's not the first choice a coach, manager, or general uses as a rallying cry to arouse deep emotion and inspire the troops. It's not what you say to yourself as you take a deep breath and dive into a challenge or face competition. And Dickens never had Scrooge utter these words as he took command of his transformed life. Yet productive is exactly what Scrooge was. And there's no better word than productivity to describe what you want from what you do when the outcome matters. We're always doing something. Working, playing, eating, sleeping, standing, sitting, or breathing. If we're alive, we're doing something. Even if we're doing nothing, that's something. Every minute of every day, the question is never, will we be doing something? But rather, what that something is we'll be doing. Sometimes what we do doesn't matter, but sometimes it does. And when it does, what we do defines our life more than anything else. In the end, putting together a life of extraordinary results simply comes down to getting the most out of what you do when what you do matters. Living for productivity produces extraordinary results. Whenever I teach productivity, I always start by asking, what type of time-managing system do you use? The answers are as varied as the number of people in the room. Paper calendar, electronic calendar, day timer, at-a-glance weekly planner. You name it, and I hear it. I then ask, so how did you choose yours? The reasons cited come in every shape, size, color, price, and criteria imaginable, but the students invariably describe the format, not the function. What they are, not how they work. So when I say that's great, but what kind of system do you use? The answer is always the same. What do you mean? I continue to say, well, if everyone has the same amount of time, and yet some earn more than others, can we say that it's how we use our time that determines the money we make? Everyone always agrees. So I go on. If this is true, that time is money, then the best way to describe a time-managing system might just be by the money it makes. So do you think you're using the $10,000-a-year system, the $20,000-a-year system, the $50,000, $100,000, or $500,000-a-year system? Are you using the $1 million-plus system? And then, silence. Until inevitably someone asks, how do we know? To which I reply, how much do you make? If money is a metaphor for producing results, then it's clear. A time-managing system's success can be judged by the productivity it produces. The strange thing about my life is that I've never worked for anyone who wasn't a millionaire or didn't become one. I didn't set out for this to happen. It just did. And the most important thing I learned from these experiences is that the most successful people are the most productive people.
Francine J. said, "My goal is no longer to get more done, but rather to have less to do."
Productive people get more done, achieve better results, and earn far more in their hours than the rest. They do so because they devote maximum time to being productive on their top priority, their one thing. They time block their one thing and then protect their time blocks with a vengeance. They've connected the dots between working their time blocks consistently and the extraordinary results they seek.
Time blocking.
I often say that I come from a long line of lethargic people. This is usually good for a laugh, but it's also true. It seems at times that my genes just might have more in common with the tortoise than the hare. On the other hand, some of the people I work with are so blessed with energy they actually vibrate. Amazingly, they're able to work long hours over extended periods and never wear down. When I try to follow suit, in less than a week, my body simply falls apart. I've discovered that, no matter how hard I try, I can't use more time as my main means of doing more. It's just not physically possible for me. So given my constraints, I've had to find a way to be highly productive in the hours I can put in. What's the solution? It's time blocking. Most people think that there's never enough time to be successful, but there is when you block it. Time blocking is a very results-oriented way of viewing and using time. It's a way of making sure that what has to be done gets done. Alexander Graham Bell said, "Concentrate all your thoughts upon the work at hand. The sun's rays do not burn until brought to a focus." Time blocking harnesses your energy and centers it on your most important work. It's productivity's greatest power tool. So, go to your calendar and block off all the time you need to accomplish your one thing. If it's a one-time one thing, block off the appropriate hours and days. If it's a regular thing, block off the appropriate time every day so it becomes a habit. Everything else, other projects, paperwork, email, calls, correspondence, meetings, and all the other stuff must wait. When you time block like this, you're creating the most productive day possible in a way that's repeatable every day for the rest of your life. Unfortunately, if you're like most individuals, your typical day might look something like Figure 27, which you can view online at theonething.com. Here you see what happens when you find yourself with less and less time to focus on what matters most. Your one thing gets a very small percentage of your day, while everything else takes a very large percentage. The most productive people's day is dramatically different and illustrated in Figure 28. Your one thing now gets 50% of the day, leaving everything else to fit into the other 50% of your day. If disproportionate results come from one activity, then you must give that one activity disproportionate time. Each and every day, ask this focusing question for your blocked time. Today, what's the one thing I can do for my one thing, such that by doing it, everything else will be easier or unnecessary? When you find the answer, you'll be doing the most leveraged activity for your most leveraged work. This is how results become extraordinary. Those who do this, in my experience, are the ones who not only become the most accomplished, but who also have the most career opportunities. Slowly but surely, they become known in their organization for their one thing and become irreplaceable. Ultimately, no one can imagine or tolerate the cost of losing them. Note that the opposite is equally true for those lost in the land of everything else. Once you've done your one thing for the day, you can devote the rest of it to everything else. Just use the focusing question to identify your next priority and give that task the time it deserves. Repeat this approach until your workday is done. Getting everything else done may help you sleep better at night, but it's unlikely to earn you a promotion. Online, in Figure 29, you'll find a sample time-blocking calendar which illustrates an effective way to block out time for your one thing. Time-blocking works on the premise that a calendar records appointments but doesn't care who those appointments are with. So when you know your one thing, make an appointment with yourself to tackle it. Every day, great salespeople generate leads, great programmers program, and great artists paint. Take any profession or any position and fill in the blank. Great success shows up when time is devoted every day to becoming great. To achieve extraordinary results and experience greatness, time block these three things in the following order. First, time block your time off. Second, time block your one thing. And third, time block your planning time.
Number one, time block your time off.
Extraordinarily successful people launch their year by taking time out to plan their time off. Why? Because they know they'll need it, and they know they'll be able to afford it. In truth, the most successful simply see themselves as working between vacations. On the other hand, the least successful don't reserve time off because they don't think they'll deserve it or be able to afford it. By planning your time off in advance, you are, in effect, managing your work time around your downtime instead of the other way around. You're also letting everyone else know well in advance when you'll be out, so they can plan accordingly. When you intend to be successful, you start by protecting time to recharge and reward yourself. Take time off. Block out long weekends and long vacations, then take them. You'll be more rested, more relaxed, and more productive afterward. Everything needs rest to function better, and you're no different. Resting is as important as working. There are a few examples of successful people who violate this, but they are not our role models. They succeed in spite of how they rest and renew, not because of it.
Number two, time block your one thing.
After you've time blocked your time off, time block your one thing. Yes, you heard that right. Your most important work comes second. Why? Because you can't happily sustain success in your professional life if you neglect your personal recreation time. Time block your time off and then make time for your one thing. The most productive people, the ones who experience extraordinary results, design their days around doing their one thing. Their most important appointment each day is with themselves, and they never miss it. If they complete their one thing before their time block is done, they don't necessarily call it a day. They use the focusing question to tell them how they can use the time they have left. Similarly, if they have a specific goal for their one thing, they finish it, regardless of the time. In the book, A Geography of Time, Robert Levine points out that most people work on clock time, as in, it's 5 o'clock, I'll see you tomorrow. Others work on event time, which is, my work is done when it's done. Think about it. The dairy farmer doesn't get to knock off at any certain time. He goes home when the cows have been milked. It's the same for any position in any profession where results matter. The most productive people work on event time. They don't quit until their one thing is done.
Ambrose Bierce said, day, noun, a period of 24 hours, mostly misspent.
The key to making this work is to block time as early in your day as you possibly can. Give yourself 30 minutes to an hour to take care of morning priorities, then move to your one thing. My recommendation is to block 4 hours a day. This isn't a typo. I repeat, 4 hours a day. Honestly, that's the minimum. If you can do more, then do it. In the book, On Writing, Stephen King describes his workflow. He says, my own schedule is pretty clear-cut. Mornings belong to whatever is new, the current composition. Afternoons are for naps and letters. Evenings are for reading, family, Red Sox games on TV, and any revisions that just cannot wait. Basically, mornings are my prime writing time. 4 hours a day may scare you more than King's novels, but you can't argue with his results. Stephen King is one of the most successful and prolific writers of our time. Whenever I tell this story, there is always one person who says to me, well, sure, it's easy for Stephen King. He's Stephen King. To that I simply say, I think the question you must ask yourself is this. Does he get to do this because he is Stephen King, or is he Stephen King because he does this? That invariably stops the discussion cold. Like so many other successful writers, early in his career, King had to find his time blocks where he could. sometimes mornings, evenings, or even lunch breaks, because his day job didn't accommodate his ambition for his life. Once extraordinary results started showing up and he could earn a living from his one thing, he was able to move his time blocks to a more sustainable time.
Peter Drucker said, "Efficiency is doing the thing right. Effectiveness is doing the right thing."
An executive assistant on our team recently transitioned to blocking large chunks of time for a project. It was stressful at first. She was continually interrupted, email alerts pinged, colleagues dropped by, team members provided a steady stream of requests for her time. These weren't even distractions, they were her job. In the end, she had to borrow a laptop and book a conference room to escape drive-bys and random non-urgent requests. But within just a week, everyone became accustomed to the fact that for regular periods of time, she would not be accessible. They adjusted. It took a week. Not a month or year. A week. Meetings got rescheduled and life went on, and she experienced a huge leap in productivity. No matter who you are, large time blocks work. Paul Graham's 2009 essay, Maker's Schedule, Manager's Schedule, underscores the need for large time blocks. Graham, one of the founders of the innovative venture capital firm Y Combinator, argues that normal business culture gets in the way of the very productivity it seeks because of the way people traditionally schedule or are allowed to schedule their time. Graham divides all work into two buckets: maker, which is to do or create, and manager, to oversee or direct. Maker time requires large blocks of the clock to write code, develop ideas, generate leads, recruit people, produce products, or execute on projects and plans. This time tends to be viewed in half-day increments. Manager time, on the other hand, gets divided into hours. This time typically has one moving from meeting to meeting, and because those who oversee or direct tend to have power and authority, they are in a position to make everyone resonate at their frequency. This can create a huge conflict if those needing maker time are pulled into meetings at odd hours, destroying the very time blocks they need to move themselves and the company forward. Graham embraced this insight and created a company culture at Y Combinator that now runs completely on a maker's schedule. All meetings get clustered at the end of the day. To experience extraordinary results, be a maker in the morning and a manager in the afternoon. Your goal is one and done. But if you don't time block each day to do your one thing won't become a done thing.
Number 3. Time block your planning time.
The last priority you time block is planning time. This is when you reflect on where you are and where you want to go. For annual planning, schedule this time late enough in the year that you have a sense of your trajectory, but not so late that you lose your running start for the next. Take a look at your someday and five-year goals and assess the progress you must make in the next year to be on track. You may even add new goals, re-envision old ones, or eliminate any that no longer reflect your purpose or priorities. Block an hour each week to review your annual and monthly goals. First, ask what needs to happen that month for you to be on target for your annual goals. Then ask what must happen that week to be on course for your monthly goals. You're essentially asking, based on where I am right now, what's the one thing I need to do this week to stay on track for my monthly goal? And for my monthly goal to be on track for my annual goal? You're lining up the dominoes. Decide how much time you'll need to achieve this and reserve that amount of time on your calendar. In effect, you could say that when you time block your planning time, you're really blocking your time to time block. Think about it. In July 2007, software developer Brad Isaac shared a productivity secret he reportedly got from comedian Jerry Seinfeld. Before Seinfeld was a household name and still regularly toured, Isaac ran into him at an open mic comedy club and asked him for advice on how to be a better comedian. Seinfeld told him the key was to write jokes, which is his one thing, every day. And the way he'd figured out how to make that happen was to hang a huge annual calendar on the wall and then put a big red X across every day he worked on his craft. Seinfeld said, after a few days, you'll have a chain. Just keep at it, and the chain will grow longer every day. You'll like seeing the chain, especially when you get a few weeks under your belt. Your only job is to not break the chain. Don't break the chain. Figure 30, found on our website, shows a sample of what a time-blocking calendar looks like if you follow the chain. The X's add up to extraordinary results. What I love about Seinfeld's method is that it resonates with everything I know to be true. It's simple, it's based on doing one thing, and it creates its own momentum. You could look at the calendar and be overwhelmed, asking yourself, how can I commit to this for an entire year? But the system is designed to bring your biggest goal to the now and focus on making the next X. As Walter Elliott said, perseverance is not a long race. It is many short races, one after another. As you complete these short races and get a chain going, it gets easier. Momentum and motivation start to take over. There is magic in knocking down your most important domino day after day. All you have to do is avoid breaking the chain one day at a time until you generate a powerful new habit in your life, the time-blocking habit. Does this sound simple? Time block is simple if you protect it.
Protect your time block.
For time blocks to actually block time, they must be protected. Although time blocking isn't hard, protecting the time you've blocked is. The world doesn't know your purpose or priorities and isn't responsible for them. You are. So it's your job to protect your time blocks from all those who don't know what matters most to you and from yourself when you forget. The best way to protect your time blocks is to adopt the mindset that they can't be moved. So when someone tries to double book you, just say, I'm sorry, I already have an appointment at that time, and offer other options. If the other person is disappointed, you're sympathetic but ultimately unmoved. Extraordinarily results-oriented people, that is, the very people who have the most demands on their time, do this every day. They keep their most important appointment. The toughest part is navigating a high-level request. How do you say no to anyone important, like your boss, a key client, or your mom, or anyone who asks you to do something with a high sense of urgency? One way is to say yes and then ask, if I have that done by a specific time in the future, would that work? Most often, these requests are more about an immediate need to hand a task off than about a need for it to be done immediately. So the requester usually just wants to know it will get done. Sometimes the request is real, needs to be done now, and you must drop what you're doing and do it. In this situation, follow the rule, if you erase, you must replace, and immediately reschedule your time block. Then there's you. If you're already feeling overbooked and overworked, it can seem incredibly challenging to hold to a time block. It can be hard to imagine how everything else will get done when so much time is given to one thing. The key is to fully internalize the domino fall that will happen when your one thing gets done. And remember that everything else you might do or have to do will be easier or unnecessary. When I first began to time block, the most effective thing I did was to put up a sheet of paper that said, until my one thing is done, everything else is a distraction. Try it. Put it where you can see it and others can see it as well. Then make this the mantra you say to yourself and everyone else. In time, others will begin to understand how you work and support it. Just watch. The last thing that can knock you off your time block is when you can't free your mind. Day in and day out, your own need to do other things instead of your one thing may be your biggest challenge to overcome. Life doesn't simplify itself the moment you simplify your focus. There's always other stuff screaming to be done. So when stuff pops into your head, just write it down on a task list and get back to what you're supposed to be doing. In other words, do a brain dump, then put it out of sight and out of mind until its time comes. In the end, there are plenty of ways your time block can get sabotaged. Here are 4 proven ways to battle distractions and keep your eye on your one thing.
Number 1. Build a bunker.
Find somewhere to work that takes you out of the path of disruption and interruption. If you have an office, get a Do Not Disturb sign. If your office has glass walls, install shades. If you work in a cubicle, get permission to put up a folding screen. If necessary, go elsewhere. The immortal Ernest Hemingway kept a strict writing schedule starting at 7 every morning in his bedroom. The mortal, but still immensely talented, business author Dan Heath bought an old laptop, deleted all its browsers, and for good measure, deleted its wireless network drivers. He would take his Wayback Machine to a coffee shop to avoid distractions. Between the two extremes, you could just find a vacant room and simply close the door.
Number 2. Store provisions.
Have any supplies, materials, snacks, or beverages you need on hand, and, other than for a bathroom break, avoid leaving your bunker. A simple trip to the coffee machine can derail your day, should you encounter someone seeking to make you a part of theirs.
Number 3. Sweep for mines.
Turn off your phone, shut down your email, and exit your internet browser. Your most important work deserves 100% of your attention.
Number 4. Enlist support.
Tell those most likely to seek you out what you're doing and when you'll be available. It's amazing how accommodating others are when they see the big picture and know when they can access you. If, ultimately, you continue a tug of war to make time blocking take place, then use the focusing question to ask, what's the one thing I can do to protect my time block every day, such that by doing it, everything else I might do will be easier or unnecessary?
Big ideas. Connect the dots. Extraordinary results become possible when where you want to go is completely aligned with what you do today. Tap into your purpose and allow that clarity to dictate your priorities. With your priorities clear, the only logical course is to go to work. Time block your one thing. The best way to make your one thing happen is to make regular appointments with yourself. Block time early in the day and block big chunks of it, no less than 4 hours. Think of it this way. If your time blocking were on trial, would your calendar contain enough evidence to convict you? Protect your time block at all costs. Time blocking works only when your mantra is, nothing and no one has permission to distract me from my one thing. Unfortunately, your resolve won't keep the world from trying, so be creative when you can be, and firm when you must. Your time block is the most important meeting of your day, so whatever it takes to protect it is what you have to do.
The people who achieve extraordinary results don't achieve them by working more hours. They achieve them by getting more done in the hours they work. Time blocking is one thing. Productive time blocking is another.
Chapter 16, The Three Commitments. George Halas said, "Nobody who ever gave his best regretted it."
Achieving extraordinary results through time blocking requires 3 commitments. First, you must adopt the mindset of someone seeking mastery. Mastery is a commitment to becoming your best, so to achieve extraordinary results, you must embrace the extraordinary effort it represents. Second, you must continually seek the very best ways of doing things. Nothing is more futile than doing your best using an approach that can't deliver results equal to your effort. And last, you must be willing to be held accountable to doing everything you can to achieve your one thing. Live these commitments, and you give yourself a fighting chance to experience extraordinary.
The 3 commitments to your one thing.
Commitment 1 is follow the path of mastery. Commitment 2, move from E to P. And commitment three is live the accountability cycle.
Commitment one, follow the path of mastery.
Mastery isn't a word we often hear anymore, but it's as critical as ever to achieving extraordinary results. As intimidating as it might initially seem, when you can see mastery as a path you go down instead of a destination you arrive at, it starts to feel accessible and attainable. Most assume mastery is an end result, but at its core, mastery is a way of thinking, a way of acting, and a journey you experience. When what you've chosen to master is the right thing, then pursuing mastery of it will make everything else you do either easier or no longer necessary. That's why what you choose to master matters. Mastery plays a key role in your domino run. I believe the healthy view of mastery means giving the best you have to become the best you can be at your most important work. The path is one of an apprentice learning and relearning the basics on a never-ending journey of greater experience and expertise. Think of it this way. At some point, white belts training to advance know the same basic karate moves black belts know. They simply haven't practiced enough to be able to do them as well. The creativity you see at a black belt level comes from mastery of the white belt fundamentals. Since there is always another level to learn, mastery actually means you're a master of what you know and an apprentice of what you don't. In other words, we become masters of what is behind us and apprentices for what is ahead. This is why mastery is a journey. Alex Van Halen has said that when he would go out at night, his brother, Eddie, would be sitting on his bed practicing the guitar, and when he came home many hours later, Eddie would be in the same place, still practicing. That's the journey of mastery. It never ends. In 1993, psychologist K. Anders Ericsson published The Role of Deliberate Practice in the Acquisition of Expert Performance in the journal Psychological Review. As the benchmark for understanding mastery, this article debunked the idea that an expert performer was gifted, a natural, or even a prodigy. Ericsson essentially gave us our first real insights into mastery and birthed the idea of the 10,000-hour rule. His research identified a common pattern of regular and deliberate practice over the course of years in elite performers that made them what they are. In one study, elite violinists had separated themselves from all others by each accumulating more than 10,000 hours of practice by age 20, thus the rule. Many elite performers complete their journey in about 10 years, which, if you do the math, is an average of about 3 hours of deliberate practice a day, every day, 365 days a year. Now, if your one thing relates to work, and you put in 250 workdays a year, assuming 5 days a week for 50 weeks, to keep pace on your mastery journey, you'll need to average 4 hours a day. Does this sound familiar? 4 hours is not a random number. That's the amount of time you need to time block every day for your one thing. More than anything else, expertise tracks with hours invested. Michelangelo once said, "If the people know how hard I had to work to gain my mastery, it wouldn't seem wonderful at all." His point is obvious. Time on a task over time eventually beats talent every time. I'd say you can book that, but actually, you should block it. When you commit to time block your one thing, make sure you approach it with a mastery mentality. This will give you the best opportunity to be the most productive you can be, and ultimately, the best you can become. And here's what's interesting. The more productive you are, the more likely you are to receive several additional payoffs you would otherwise have missed. The pursuit of mastery bears gifts. As you progress along the path of mastery, both your self-confidence and your success competence will grow. You'll make a discovery. The path of mastery is not so different from one pursuit to the next. What might pleasantly surprise you is how giving yourself over to mastering one thing serves as a platform for and speeds up the process of doing other things. Knowledge begets knowledge, and skills build on skills. It's what makes future dominoes fall more easily. Mastery is a pursuit that keeps giving, because it's a path that never ends. In his landmark book, Mastery, George Leonard tells the story of Jigoro Kano, the founder of judo. According to legend, as Kano approached death, he called his students around him and asked to be buried in his white belt. The symbolism wasn't lost. The highest-ranking martial artist of his discipline embraced the emblem of the beginner for his life and beyond, because to him, the journey of the successful lifelong learner was never over. Time blocking is essential to mastery, and mastery is essential to time blocking. They go hand in hand. When you do one, you do the other.
Commitment 2. Move from E to P.
When coaching top performers, I often ask, are you doing this to simply do the best you can do? Or are you doing this to do it the best it can be done? Although it's not meant to be a trick question, it trips people up anyway. Many realize that although they are giving their best effort, they aren't doing the best that could be done because they aren't willing to change what they are doing. The path of mastering something is the combination of not only doing the best you can do at it, but also doing it the best it can be done. Continually improving how you do something is critical to getting the most from time blocking. It's called moving from E to P. When we roll out of bed in the morning and start tackling the day, we do so in one of two ways. Entrepreneurial, that's the E, or purposeful, which refers to the P. Entrepreneurial is our natural approach. It's seeing something we want to do or that needs to be done and racing off to do it with enthusiasm, energy, and our natural abilities. No matter the task, all natural ability has a ceiling of achievement, a level of productivity and success that eventually tops out. Although this varies from person to person and task to task, everybody in life has a natural ceiling for everything. Give some people a hammer and they're an instant carpenter. Give one to me and I'm all thumbs. In other words, some people can naturally use a hammer extremely well with minimal instruction or practice, but there are others, like me, who hit their ceiling of achievement the moment they're holding one. If the outcome of your efforts is acceptable at whatever level of achievement you reach, then you high-five and move on. But when you're going about your one thing, any ceiling of achievement must be challenged. And this requires a different approach, a purposeful approach. Highly productive people don't accept the limitations of their natural approach as the final word on their success. When they hit a ceiling of achievement, they look for new models and systems, better ways to do things to push them through. They pause just long enough to examine their options. They pick the best one, and then they're right back at it. Ask an E to cut some firewood, and the entrepreneurial person would likely shoulder an axe and head straight for the woods. On the other hand, the purposeful person might ask, "Where can I get a chainsaw?" With a P mindset, you can achieve breakthroughs and accomplish things far beyond your natural abilities. You must simply be willing to do whatever it takes. Figure 31, found online at theonething.com, explores both the entrepreneurial and purposeful approaches and the different stages that come before each mindset reaches their natural ceiling of achievement. With the entrepreneurial approach, the first stage is disappointment, followed by resignation and greener pastures. Then the cycle continues. With the purposeful approach, however, the first stage is focus, followed by models, then systems, and finally breaking through the natural ceiling of achievement. In the long run, P beats E every time. You can't put limits on what you'll do. You have to be open to new ideas and new ways of doing things if you want breakthroughs in your life. As you travel the path of mastery, you'll find yourself continually challenged to do new things. The purposeful person follows the simple rule that a different result requires doing something different. Make this your mantra, and breakthroughs become possible. Too many people reach a level where their performance is good enough, and then stop working on getting better. People on the path to mastery avoid this by continually upping their goal, challenging themselves to break through their current ceiling, and staying the forever apprentice. It's what writer and memory champion Joshua Ford dubbed the OK plateau. He illustrated it with typing. If practice time were all that mattered, over the course of our professional careers, with the millions of memos and emails we type, we'd all progress from the lowly chicken peck to 100 words a minute. But that doesn't happen. We reach a level of skill we deem to be acceptable, and then simply switch off the learning. We go on automatic pilot and hit one of the most common ceilings of achievement. We hit the OK plateau. When you're in search of extraordinary results, accepting an OK plateau or any other ceiling of achievement isn't OK when it applies to your one thing. When you want to break through plateaus and ceilings, there is only one approach, the P approach. In business and in life, we all start off entrepreneurially. We go after something with our current levels of abilities, energy, knowledge, and effort. In short, everything that comes easily. Approaching things with E is comfortable because it feels natural. It's who we currently are and how we currently like to do things. It's also limiting. When E is our only approach, we create artificial limits to what we can achieve and who we can become. If we tackle something with all E and then hit a ceiling of achievement, we simply bounce up against it over and over and over. This continues until we just can't take the disappointment anymore, become resigned to this being the only outcome we can ever have, and eventually seek out greener pastures elsewhere. When we think we've maxed out our potential in a situation, starting over is how we think we'll get ahead. The problem is, this becomes a vicious cycle of taking on the next new thing with renewed enthusiasm, energy, natural ability, and effort, until another ceiling is hit and disappointment and resignation set in once again. And then it's on to the next greener pasture. Bring P to the same ceiling and things look different. The purposeful approach says, I'm still committed to growing, so what are my options? You then use the focusing question to narrow those choices down to the next thing you should do. It could be to follow a new model, get a new system, or both. But be prepared. Implementing these may require new thinking, new skills, and even new relationships. Probably none of this will feel natural at first. That's okay. Being purposeful is often about doing what comes unnaturally. But when you're committed to achieving extraordinary results, you simply do whatever it takes anyway. When you've done the best you can do, but are certain the results aren't the best they can be, get out of E and into P. Look for the better models and systems, the ways that can take you farther. Then adopt new thinking, new skills, and new relationships to help you put them into action. Become purposeful during your time block and unlock your potential.
Commitment 3. Live the accountability cycle.
There is an undeniable connection between what you do and what you get. Actions determine outcomes, and outcomes inform actions. Be accountable, and this feedback loop is how you discover the things you must do to achieve extraordinary results. That's why your final commitment is to live the accountability cycle of results. Taking complete ownership of your outcomes by holding no one but yourself responsible for them is the most powerful thing you can do to drive your success. As such, accountability is most likely the most important of the three commitments. Without it, your journey down the path of mastery will be cut short the moment you encounter a challenge. Without it, you won't figure out how to break through the ceilings of achievement you'll hit along the way. Accountable people absorb setbacks and keep going. Accountable people persevere through problems and keep pushing forward. Accountable people are results-oriented and never defend actions, skill levels, models, systems, or relationships that just aren't getting the job done. They bring their best to whatever it takes without reservation. Accountable people achieve results others only dream of. When life happens, You can be either the author of your life or the victim of it. Those are your only two choices, accountable or unaccountable. This may sound harsh, but it's true. Every day we choose one approach or the other, and the consequences follow us forever. Online Figure 32 visually represents how each type of person, accountable and unaccountable, approaches life. To illustrate the difference, consider the tale of two managers of two competing businesses who both experience a sudden shift in the market. One month there is a continuous line of customers stretching out the door. The next, no one shows up. How each manager responds makes all the difference. The accountable manager immediately tunes in and asks, "What's happening here?" She investigates exactly what she's up against. The other manager refuses to acknowledge what's happening and convinces himself that it's a blip, a glitch, an anomaly. He shrugs it off as simply a bad month. Meanwhile, the accountable manager, having discovered how a competitor is grabbing market share, bites the bullet and says, "So this is the way it is," and takes ownership of the problem. She thinks, "If it's to be, it's up to me." Being willing to address reality head-on gives her a huge edge. It puts her in a position to start thinking about what she can do differently. The other manager keeps fighting reality. He comes up with an alternative view, placing responsibility elsewhere. "That's not how I see it," he counters. "If people in the company would just do their jobs, we wouldn't have problems like this." The accountable manager looks for solutions. More important, she assumes she's a part of the solution, asking, "What can I do?" The moment she finds the right tactic, she acts. "Circumstances won't change by themselves," she thinks. "So let's get on with it." The other manager, having blamed everyone else, now excuses himself altogether. "It's not my job," he declares, and settles in to hoping things change for the better. Told in this way, the difference is pretty stark, isn't it? One is actively trying to author her destiny. The other is simply along for the ride. One is being accountable. The other is being a victim. One will change the outcome. One won't. Granted, victim is a tough word. Please know that I'm describing the attitude, not the person. Though if kept up long enough, these could become one and the same. No one is a born victim. It's simply an attitude or an approach. But if allowed to persist, the cycle becomes a habit. The opposite is also true. Anyone can be accountable at any time, and the more you choose the cycle of accountability, the more likely it is to become your automatic answer to any adversity. Highly successful people are clear about their role in the events of their life. They don't fear reality. They seek it, acknowledge it, and own it. They know this is the only way to uncover new solutions, apply them, and experience a different reality, so they take responsibility and run with it. They see outcomes as information they can use to frame better actions to get better outcomes. It's a cycle they understand and use to achieve extraordinary results. One of the fastest ways to bring accountability to your life is to find an accountability partner. Accountability can come from a mentor, a peer, or in its highest form, a coach. Whatever the case, it's critical that you acquire an accountability relationship and give your partner license to lay out the honest truth. An accountability partner isn't a cheerleader, although he can lift you up. An accountability partner provides frank, objective feedback on your performance, creates an ongoing expectation for productive progress, and can provide critical brainstorming or even expertise when needed. As for me, a coach or a mentor is the best choice for an accountability partner. Although a peer or a friend can absolutely help you see things you may not see, ongoing accountability is best provided by someone to whom you agree to be truly accountable. When that's the nature of the relationship, the best results occur. Earlier, I discussed Dr. Gail Matthews' research that individuals with written goals were 39.5% more likely to succeed. But there's more to the story. Individuals who wrote their goals and sent progress reports to friends were 76.7% more likely to achieve them. As effective as writing down your goals can be, simply sharing your progress toward your goals with someone regularly, even just a friend, makes you almost twice as effective. Accountability works. Erickson's research on expert performance confirms the same relationship between elite performance and coaching. He observed that the single most important difference between these amateurs and the three groups of elite performers is that the future elite performers seek out teachers and coaches and engage in supervised training, whereas the amateurs rarely engage in similar types of practice. An accountability partner will positively impact your productivity. They'll keep you honest and on track. Just knowing they are waiting for your next progress report can spur you to better results. Ideally, a coach can coach you on how to maximize your performance over time. This is how the very best become the very best. Coaching will help you with all three commitments to your one thing. On the path to mastery, on the journey from E to P, and in living the accountability cycle, a coach is invaluable. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find elite achievers who don't have coaches helping them in key areas of their life. It's never too soon or too late to get a coach. Commit to achieving extraordinary results, and you'll find a coach gives you the best chance possible.
Big ideas. Commit to be your best. Extraordinary results happen only when you give the best you have to become the best you can be at your most important work. This is, in essence, the path to mastery. And because mastery takes time, it takes a commitment to achieve it. Be purposeful about your one thing. Move from E to P. Go on a quest for the models and systems that can take you the farthest. Don't just settle for what comes naturally. Be open to new thinking, new skills, and new relationships. If the path of mastery is a commitment to be your best, being purposeful is a commitment to adopt the best possible approach. Take ownership of your outcomes. If extraordinary results are what you want, being a victim won't work. Change occurs only when you're accountable. So stay out of the passenger seat and always choose the driver's side. Find a coach. You'll be hard-pressed to find anyone who achieves extraordinary results without one.
Remember, we're not talking about ordinary results. Extraordinary is what we're after. That kind of productivity eludes most, but it doesn't have to. When you time block your most important priority, protect your time block, and then work your time block as effectively as possible, you'll be as productive as you can be. You'll be living the power of the one thing. Now you just have to avoid getting hijacked.
Chapter 17, The Four Thieves. John Carmack said, "Focus is a matter of deciding what things you're not going to do."
In 1973, a group of seminary students unknowingly participated in a grand study known as the Good Samaritan Experiment. These students were recruited and divided into two groups to see what factors influenced whether or not they would help a stranger in distress. Some were told they were going to prepare a talk about seminary jobs. The others, that they were going to give a talk about the parable of the Good Samaritan, a biblical story about helping people in need. Within each group, some were told they were late and had to hurry to their destination, while others were told they could take their time. What the students didn't know was that researchers had planted a man along the way. He was slumped on the ground, coughing, and apparently in distress. In the end, fewer than half the students stopped to help. But the deciding factor wasn't the task, it was time. 90% of the students who were rushed failed to stop and render aid to the stranger. Some actually stepped over him in their hurry to get where they were supposed to go. It didn't seem to matter that half of them were on their way to deliver a talk on helping others. Now, if seminary students can so easily lose focus on their real priority, do the rest of us even have a prayer? Clearly, our best intentions can easily be undone. Just as there are six lies that will deceive and mislead you, There are four thieves that can hold you up and rob you of your productivity. And since there's no one standing